Welcome! This week we're going to learn about how students learn and how you can help them do that. To do this, we're going to lightly skim over entire disciplines of cognitive understanding, educational psychology, and so forth, and just sort of hit some highlights. If you know more about those fields, you'll likely think that I'm glossing over some important details, and I am, but I'm trying to hit enough that you'll understand where you ought to go as you go about teaching and understand why good teaching is good teaching. So to start with, we're going to talk about this image here, an eye looking at a fish. Let's talk about what happens when you look at a fish. First, a photon hits the fish, bounces off, and enters your eye. We call this computer graphics. Everybody else calls it optics. That then gets translated into some sort of bioelectrical signal and goes back to the optic center of your brain, which processes it and notices sort of regions of color. Okay? So there's some automated affairs, I understand, mostly born with ability to recognize regions of color and lines and boundaries and so forth. Some magic happens, and eventually your frontal lobe, or prefrontal cortex more precisely, where you seem to be doing most of your conscious processing, gets fish as a signal. Now, if you think about the fact that this happens, it's kind of weird. When you consider what I have drawn on the board, and then consider what real fish look like, they have very little in common. This is not glistening, doesn't have scales, isn't colored, it's just a few dark lines on a pale background. And yet, it is likely that you can't look at this and not see a fish, no matter how hard you try. Now, this is not something you're born with. Unlike your optic center, you aren't born with an understanding of fish. This is something you learn and develop over the course of your life. And that ability to learn these sorts of things is an important aspect of what we're going to talk about as we're talking about how to teach. So how does this happen? Well, the key to it occurs because inside your brain, you have these little automated sub-processors. They aren't really localized like I'm drawing them, but each of them will take some input and produce some higher level output. So one of them might recognize a circle, and another one might combine a circle with some other information to say, ah, I think that might be an eye, and so forth. These are learned, automated, subconscious processing. Okay? What do we call these things? We call several of them either schemata or schemata, depending on how you like to do your Greek plurals. One of them would therefore just be a schema. Okay? And these exist in your brain, they are learned and developed, they do their work subconsciously so that when you see a drawing of a fish, your brain just tells you it's a fish without requiring your conscious thought. So the concept of the schemata is an important part of understanding cognitive load theory. There's another part of this cognitive load theory we're going to use to talk about how your brain works that we're also going to need to understand, and that is memory. You can remember things, and your memory can be categorized into three types that behave differently from one another. You've got your long-term memory, your short-term memory, and your working memory. Now, there are related concepts that have similar properties in computing. As far as I understand, they were developed independently in computing compared to understanding how the brain works, but it can be useful to think about these ideas if you have them. Your long-term memory acts like a disk or like your files. Okay? What do I mean by that? I mean, it's practically infinite. It is likely you can run your entire life without filling up your long-term memory, and it doesn't go away. Once something enters your long-term memory, it is there to stay. Your ability to recall is not as permanent and is sort of this separate process, but the actual data itself appears to stay for as long as you might want it. However, it's slow to access and limited in its scope in some ways, like disks and files. Incidentally, long-term memory is where your schemata live, so it's not always slow to access. Some of it is entirely subconscious. But if you need to go hunting for a memory, that hunting process can be complicated and take time. Your short-term memory acts like RAM, or like your data structures. Okay? This has a sort of a limited space. You can run out of it fairly easy. It has limited life as well. It sort of exists and stays around for a period of sort of minutes to hours in general lifespan. Okay. It is unusual for it to make it quite the entire day, but sort of when you go to sleep is approximately when some short-term memory goes into long-term. There's an argument back and forth about whether this is the purpose of sleep or not. Anyway, short-term memory has a much better ability to store a lot of information to access quickly, but it fades. It is finite in capacity. And as the day progresses, it fills up and you start throwing some of it away. You start reclaiming that garbage using your brain's garbage collector. It's not a very efficient one. It isn't like a computer that only throws away things that are never being used. It throws away things it doesn't think will be used again quickly so that it can come and put new information in. And so, if you were watching or listening to this early in the day, everything I tell you is going to go into your short-term memory and some of it's going to be thrown away by what you do later in the day. Versus if you're doing this later in the day, I am replacing other things that have been in your short-term memory that won't make it into long-term memory as a consequence. Your working memory acts like your registers, or like your local variables. This is the stuff you use to actually do your thinking. All of your conscious thought occurs using your working memory. And in order to do your conscious thought, you have to load from long-term or short-term memory into your working memory to do the thinking with. Also, like your registers or local variables, there's just not very much of it. You aren't going to be able to store everything you know in your working memory, a very small amount at a time. So that working memory is where we do our cognition. It's what that sort of prefrontal cortex area, that conscious thought, works with. And as a rough idea, it stores three ideas. Now, idea is a fuzzy metric. This is not based on some sort of understanding of Shannon's information theory or bits or the like, but approximately you can store three ideas in your working memory at a time. And all of your thinking has to occur with just those three ideas. And ideas that work that would require more ideas than that would be very challenging for you to do. Because it's so limited and because it's so important in our thinking, we will talk about our cognitive load. That is to say, what are we loading into that working memory? And our cognitive load, we will break down into three broad categories. Now, these categories, unlike our memory categories, these are not intrinsic to the functioning of memory, rather are descriptive of the purpose of education. The purpose of education is for people to learn, and related to that, to do, right? We want people to accomplish tasks, and we want them to learn how to do those tasks more effectively. The first kind of load we have is the intrinsic load. Okay? Your intrinsic load is what you need to do the task at hand. If I want to add two numbers, I'm going to need to have those two numbers in my working memory. I can't add them if I'm not thinking about them. This is intrinsic to the task. Okay? It isn't how I'm thinking about it, it's what I am thinking. It needs that space. We also have extraneous load. This is what is unrelated to the task at hand. So if I am trying to do a math test, I should be having the numbers and operators in my head, but I may also be having worries about how well I'm doing and notices of odd odors and wondering if I'm going to have a good lunch and complaints about how I feel. All of those kinds of thoughts are extraneous. They're not related to the task at hand. But if I'm thinking about them consciously, they still take up some of that working memory. They take up some of that cognitive load. The third type that we talk about in learning, we call germane load. Now, germane is just a word that means useful or on topic. Our germane load, in particular, is taking the thinking we are doing and building, either creating a new schemata to automate it, or strengthening a schema we have, or correcting a schema that wasn't quite right. And the general concept, the understanding that's important as we're thinking about learning using cognitive load theory, is that these few ideas need to both do the learning and do the task. And so a big part of being an educator is to balance that cognitive load in the minds of our students. In general, we want them to have intrinsic load in two of these spots and germane load in a third, and no extraneous load. We want the work they're doing to be complicated enough that it takes up some reasonable amount of memory, but simple enough there's room left for them to metacognate and understand and learn and develop an automated process to do this task in the future. Now, one more thing to say about this before we transition to talking about what this means as an educator. I said that intrinsic load is what you have to do the task at hand, but that changes over time as your schema develop. Consider, for example, if I were to write this, 3 plus 7. How much cognitive load does it take for you to analyze the answer of this expression? I used as my example of intrinsic load that adding two numbers requires two numbers. And so you might think you need at least to store the 3 and the 7 in your mind, but that is actually not correct. For most of you, you have somewhere there in your brain, you have this 10 schema. A very powerful, well-developed 10 schema. It has learned to recognize a lot of ways of spelling 10. You can spell it T-E-N. You can spell it 1-0. You can spell it 3 plus 7. You can spell it 11 minus 1. You can spell it 2 times 5. You have lots and lots of things your brain has learned to completely automatically, with no cognitive effort at all, recognize as 10. So consider if we were teaching an arithmetic class, teaching people that didn't yet know how to do addition. For them, the cognitive load of 3 plus 7 can be considerable and can actually be different depending on how we write the numbers. They may have an easier time, better developed 3 schema for a 3 with an angle compared to a 3 with a curve, or a 3 with a slash compared to a 3 without, right? So it may differ significantly for them, the cognitive load, because they don't have the schemata to help pre-process. Whereas you as the teacher can just look at it and understand it with no thought at all. So the intrinsic load is a characteristic of the student and the task together. And the job of an educator is to help the student have that right amount of germane load to develop the schema that will automate the things they are doing now so that they won't take as much cognitive load in the future, so that future bigger concepts can be built out of these more developed schema and tackled where they couldn't be tackled on their own. So this is a summary of the big ideas of cognitive load theory. Okay? We have these automated processes that help us interpret information, which is important because our working memory is small and can only hold a few ideas. It's important to balance what we load in there. It's also important to understand that once things get into long-term memory, they're there to stay. But in the intermediate time, the short-term memory is very sort of fluid and will drop things. So things people are learning right now may not make it to long-term memory if we don't give enough repetitions to help them out. And this is my summary of the core ideas of cognitive load theory. Next, we'll talk about how this applies to educators and TAs.